It's episode 3, season 2 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Hi, everybody. It's Gita. It is May 2024, and it is a glorious day here on the East Coast. But I just got back from Austin. I think I mentioned last month that I was going to be the keynote speaker for the American Academy of Emergency Medicine Conference, and I want to give a shout out to them and the organizers especially, who just made me feel so welcome and made the experience and the presentation so seamless, and to the very engaged audience, most of whom were probably like, oh my God, a keynote about litigation, that does not sound fun, but you all bore with me. And I loved how energized everybody was afterwards, wanting to talk about the changes that they want to see in the future in how we teach and talk about litigation, or how their organization supports and educates physicians in litigation. And my heart is very, 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 very full. And also my stomach still from all the tacos I ate when I was there. I mentioned when I got up on stage that it was Taco Tuesday in Austin, and they made sure I got my tacos. So thank you, thank you, thank you, everybody. Now, this month, we are going to start a conversation about medical board complaints and investigations. And we're really just going to do some introductory work today with basic information about how state medical boards typically work. And of course, this will vary state to state. And hopefully what this will do is prompt you to become more informed about how your state medical board of licensure and discipline works, who is on it, how they are appointed, how they adjudicate cases, etc. Right? So this is another arena where typically doctors just have blinders on until they are the subject of a complaint. And then we do typically see the same panic, fear, stress, lack of know-how that can accompany litigation, as we've been discussing all along. So again, I think that this is something that we should know a little bit more about before we ever get entangled in an investigation. And one of the points I want to make clear today is that many good doctors do wind up being investigated by their state medical boards. I really want to make an important point. I don't think this comes out strongly enough in the interview, so I want to make it now. Doctors should have oversight. Yes, they should. We have tremendous, awesome responsibilities for our patients. And I want to make clear that I am not an apologist for bad care. And my lens is really about the good doctor who gets caught up in litigation or investigation. Because there are, I mean, let's not put too fine a point on it. There are sadly doctors who do knowingly break the law, or practice when impaired, or wantonly harm people, or are indifferent to the fact that they have a substandard skill set, or who take advantage of people. These clinicians do exist. They are, in my opinion, the tiny, 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 tiny minority, but they are why we need medical boards. They are why we need oversight. John Oliver, if you ever watch his show, recently did a piece on medical boards, and if I didn't know that there was another side to the coin, I would think the world was full of charlatan doctors, you know, bilking the system at every turn without any justice or consequence. And it was really very, very disheartening. But on the other hand, what I know to be true, and what John Oliver did not mention at all, and if someone happens to know John Oliver, please send him this, is that many, many, many good physicians are the subject of board complaints and investigations. And for them, it can feel like a very dangerously capricious process, and their license and their whole livelihood is at stake. We know that medical board investigations are related to physician suicide, and I have heard some truly horrific stories of good doctors who were so isolated and frankly bullied by the process that they made me sick to my stomach. In one 2014 retrospective analysis of physicians in Tennessee who were referred to their state medical boards for evaluation for fitness for duty over an 8-year period, a staggering 5% of them were known to have attempted or completed suicide. That was 7 physicians out of 141, and 5 of them died. And that is just one sample in one state. And that leads me to conclude that even if some of these investigations were warranted, we are not paying enough attention to how this process is conducted. Now, some of you listening might even be on a medical board, and I want to recognize that it is a very hard and likely mostly thankless job. On the one hand, you have these John Oliver type exposés that say that you're useless in keeping bad doctors from practicing. And on the other hand, you have someone like me over here saying that board processes are driving healthcare workers to suicide. Both people who are being investigated, and also we've been looking a lot at the language that boards use in licensure questions that might actually inhibit medical professionals from getting mental health care and contributing to this whole healthcare crisis right now. So I could see how this would make you want to just throw your hands up. But the work is so important. I mean, the board in our state was where recently a number of concerned healthcare workers went to contest a hospital policy that they thought was unsafe for patient care, and they won. And you're also going to hear me tell a story in this interview coming up about a time the board was doing something that I thought was horribly unfair. So we need to value the role that the board plays and the work that they do, and also make that work less opaque and more open to feedback. It is the powerlessness of the doctor who winds up being investigated that is the dangerous part, in my opinion. We need good doctors who care about the health of the public and the well-being of the healthcare workforce. We need good doctors like that to serve in this capacity. So this is a conversation that we need to keep going. And if there is someone who is on a medical board who would like to serve as a counterpoint for the interview you are about to hear with a healthcare law attorney, then I would be interested in hearing from you. So my website is in the show notes. And without further ado, let us get to today's interview. Today, I have as my guest Guillermo Beatriz Esquire, who is a partner in Fryer Levitt's healthcare litigation department. And Fryer Levitt is a national boutique law firm focused exclusively on healthcare and life sciences, and they have offices in New Jersey and in New York City. Attorney Beatriz co-chairs the firm's insurance defense group, and he represents healthcare professionals in a broad range of administrative, civil, and criminal healthcare matters. And he also has extensive litigation experience before state licensing authorities and medical boards, federal healthcare agencies, and state healthcare agencies. He represents practices and healthcare professionals in matters concerning credentialing and denial of privileges, administrative discipline, Medicare audits, hospital fair hearings, post-payment demands, and prepayment audits. I'm really happy to have him and his expertise here today. And without further ado, let's begin. Hi, Guillermo. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk to our listeners about this. I think medical board investigations are something that, unfortunately, some of us are familiar with, but a lot of us just kind of live in fear or have no idea what they're about.
Thank you, Gita, for having me. Yes, I think a lot of this is an issue that most doctors will never have to deal with, thankfully. There are many times when well-meaning, completely innocent, and we don't use that word in law very much, but completely innocent doctors get brought into the system. And my goal here today is if we can try to demystify this issue and try to clarify the things that you should and shouldn't do, because as we'll discuss, the board has quite a bit of power over licenses.
In my previous season of this podcast, got a lot of correspondence from people asking to talk about medical board investigations. And I did not have any real personal expertise with medical board investigations through the course of my malpractice litigation, except that in my state, the board is notified when there's a suit like that. And so there was a letter from the board that freaked me out, but it didn't go very far. Then after my trial was over, actually, I did tangle with the board, but not as someone who was being investigated. There was a situation in my state where the board was disciplining physicians who had self-reported misses and near misses for EMR order entries when they were just starting up a new EMR in their hospital and they had been asked to report things into a, they called it safety net, but it was supposed to be a protected environment so that you could report errors in a blame-free situation so everyone could make the system safer. That was ostensibly what the system was for. And it was supposed to be protected. However, because of some other things that had happened, the hospital had an agreement with the Department of Health and Licensure that they were going to turn over some of those errors. And very quietly, the board started disciplining physicians who had self-reported ordering a wrong side thing because the mouse clicked somewhere and they ordered a left thing instead of a right thing, or just because of the format of the EMR, it made it so easy to make a mistake. And then all of a sudden, these people were getting disciplined. And I thought that this was like, I thought it was crazy. I reached out to a bunch of health and safety experts and a sort of social media campaign, and it turned into a political article. And then that was the only way, because I started with making phone calls, but that didn't work. And the court of public opinion was the only way that we actually started to make any headway with this. And then the board stopped doing that. They came to an agreement with the hospital system. But anyway, it was my first introduction to realizing that it feels political. So let's talk about that. First of all, what are your thoughts on that story?
Well, I'm not shocked. It still surprises me to see the level of oversight that boards in other states have here. I'm primarily in New Jersey, but I deal a lot with Pennsylvania and New York as well. And they have plenary power. You said it's political. They are political appointees for the most part across the nation. They're voluntary positions. That means that the legislature has decided we don't want to regulate doctors. We don't want to license doctors. We don't want to discipline doctors. So all of it is going to happen through the Board of Medical Examiners, through, you know, the Department of Health. You police your own, you license your own, you know what to do. This is your area of expertise. We're washing our hands of it. So board members have immunity. As long as they're acting in a reasonable manner and they're doing something that's not arbitrary and capricious or malicious or intentional, you can't sue them. So they have this power to do whatever they want. And a lot of times they get away with it. The reason they get away with it is because, we'll talk about it a little later, but throughout the process, you're dealing in their home court. So you're getting hometowned a lot, and it's very difficult for a provider to challenge the board unless you're in really, really, really good, strong footing. And the case you just talked about, I think that's one of those cases where I don't think if they had gone to an administrative law judge, somebody who would have adjudicated a dispute between a board and a provider would have said, yeah, no, this quality review that they were doing, this essential feedback that they were providing to the EMR system, that's clearly something where they signed up to be disciplined, or that's within your purview. I think that's something that was a clear overreach. But like you said, sometimes it takes the court of public opinion, it takes calling them out in an embarrassing way to get them to move back. We had a similar situation in that the board here in New Jersey, and this has happened now in multiple states, but they discovered that there was a company that was credentialing, I don't know if it was like certified medical assistants or someone that they were certifying. And they actually decided, because the company that gave them their certification did so in a fraudulent manner, instead of allowing the, you know, unfortunate victims of this fraud to be recredentialed, they decided to take the licenses of 600 essential, I think it was like nurses aides across the state. So it wasn't until all 600 decided to appeal that the board realized, oh, we don't have the bandwidth to do 600 hearings and to do all this stuff. So then a couple of firms got involved, including my own, and we got them to basically change their tack and say, okay, you know what? Let's take a step back. We overreached. We'll let you retake the exam. We'll let you stay credentialed for the time being. You know, we don't want to basically take away from patients in the state access to care. We'll actually go back on what we were going to do. But it wasn't until 600 of them came forward at the same time and said, okay, we'll push you on this. You know, we're not going to let you just take this plenary decision.
It took 600 of them sort of banding together And that pressure is the only thing that led them to change. And these poor people had been on the receiving end of fraud. And so really, but unfortunately, I think that knowledge about how, I think being really clear-eyed about who the medical board is. I remember early on in my practice, someone just said, oh, the medical board is not your friend. And I kind of thought they were. Like, I see them as sort of, you know, the Department of Health, they're telling us about like public health problems and alerting us to things. And like, that's great. I feel like that's helpful. And it took a while for me to realize that, no, they're not some sort of benign overlord. Now, perhaps things are changing and morphing as culture does, but I think these stories are really important to get out. And there are a lot of them, I know, because people have been reaching out to me. We're going to get into some of those stories later. But today, what I'd really like to do is just to kind of set the stage, as you started to do, of like, what's the board? Who's on the board? How do they work? And you wrote a great article in Medical Economics that I will link to in the show notes if you want to read it. It's a nice introduction, a nice primer. And so that's what I'd like to talk about today. But we are going to revisit this talking about specific stories. So, all right. The purpose of the board, you were pretty clear about, is to police. Well, what would the medical board say that their job is?
Yeah. So I think the medical board would say that they're in charge with protecting the citizens of the state, the residents of the state. And by doing that, they protect them in two ways. The first way is by licensing only people who should be licensed, you know, and then by enforcing the rules to protect.
Now, every healthcare worker group has a board to answer to, correct?
I think there are like 50 boards in New Jersey. Yeah, there's the Board of Cosmetology. If there's a license that you can get, it's usually going to have its own board.
It probably varies from state to state, since the state legislature is in charge of sort of crafting the mission of the board itself. And so who's on the board? Like, who gets to be on a board?
So typically they like to have, if possible, a nice like representation of different practices. They don't want like 20 internists. You know, they're going to want someone who's cardiologist, someone who's pain management. So it's all going to be doctors, but they usually like to have, if you know, someone who can be there as a subject matter expert, for lack of a better word, if there's a matter that comes before the board that has to deal with an area specialty or subspecialty.
Now, do those doctors still have to be working as clinicians, or do you sort of retire into that job?
New Jersey, New York, and I believe Pennsylvania, where I do most of my work. Yes, most of them are still clinicians. They are working, and there may be one or two members that are full-time staff. Usually it's a voluntary position, so they have their, you know, 9 to 5, even though doctors don't keep 9 to 5. You guys have much longer hours. But, you know, they have their full-time job, and then they'll meet once or twice a month for hearings, you know, and things of that nature.
I mean, on its surface, that sounds a little fairer than the legal system, the map where you're not being judged in any way, usually by a jury of your peers.
Yes and no. Ideally, yes. You want to be judged by your peers. However, sometimes we see doctors being harder on other doctors than juries. For a lot of people, they hold doctors in this high regard, and doctors are just seeing their peers. And it's like, oh, I wouldn't have made that mistake. Or, well, why do you have that happen in your practice? You should have more oversight. Or the more divorced a doctor is from day-to-day practice, the more they start focusing on the so-called best practices, and they're less realistic about what happens in a day-to-day. So if you were to go before a subcommittee of the board, I would make sure that, you know, you try to find out, if you can ahead of time, who's going to be on that board, who's going to be on that subcommittee. Usually a subcommittee is 3 board members, so 3 physicians and 1 deputy attorney general. Your attorney can talk to their deputy attorney general, find out who's going to be on the board that day. They may not find out until a day or two before, but you want to know, are they practicing physicians? Are they retired physicians? Are they, you know, in the research arm? Because the less you have of a clinician, the more likely they are to think of things in the idealistic, you know, best practices, but not understanding that there are real life issues that get in the way of it.
I think that it's important to understand the motivation of the board, and it's also important to understand that they have to justify their own existence and their funding and things like that. And so I'm going to read a little excerpt from a letter that someone sent me, where it was a copy of a memorandum from the medical board of a given state to someone on the legislative committee. They had to talk about what they'd done that year and sort of justify some funding that they were getting. I'm going to read this verbatim. Ahem. The success of the board's enforcement program is illustrated below. From the fiscal year X to Y, we had 47% more cases were referred to the Attorney General's office, 74% more probation violation cases were referred to the Attorney General's office, 49% more license restrictions and suspensions were imposed while the administrative active was pending, 203% more cases were referred for criminal action, 35% more revocations were issued, 25% more cases resulting in probation were issued, and 26% more disciplinary actions were issued. These improvements can be partially attributed to this blah, 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 blah model. They go on to, but the way that they are saying, like, look at all the things we did. We prosecuted so many more people. Aren't we great?
Yeah. You see that a lot, patting themselves on the back from like the Medicaid fraud division and, you know, the CMS and the OIG. Be like, look how many doctors we put away or how much money we recovered through audits. It's really poor taste, in my opinion.
I agree. Okay. But it's important to know.
Yeah. A lot of it also comes from who the Attorney General is going to be. So when you said before, oh, it seems political, it is. Because, for instance, in New Jersey right now, the last edict that came down from the Attorney General's office to the Board of Medical Examiners was, I want you to treat cases of physician misconduct, like sexual misconduct, allegations of sexual misconduct, much harsher. I want it to be like a zero tolerance type policy. So before, if you had a case where it was a so-called he said, she said case, the board would give some deference to the doctor or would really go through a process where the victim separately from the doctor, obviously not there on the same day, call in the doctor, talk to the doctor, do a very thorough examination. Whereas now it's like a couple of letters back and forth. Then it's like, okay, here's your order to surrender your license, or here is your 5-year suspension. So we saw that first with the opioid epidemic where they said, okay, we want you to treat these super harsh. And what they were doing is they were taking the best practices for prescribing in, let's say, 2019 and applying it to prescriptions written in 2014. And it's like, wait a minute, we didn't have, you know, the opioid crisis in 2014 and you could do refills at the time for a narcotic. And there were different things that you could do.
We were being told that was best practice in 2014. Like, pain is the fifth vital sign. Jayco was going to judge you if you didn't give out your refills.
It went from that to, hey, guess what? You're a drug dealer and we're going to treat you like that. And it's like, wait a minute. No, you told us for the longest time that this is what we have to do. And I saw some very well-meaning doctors retire, go to jail in some cases. There was like some horrible injustices that happened. And all of it is because, you know, they were following what they thought were best practices at the time. They were miseducated. You know, they were deceived by, you know, some of these big pharma companies. And now they were left holding the bag years later. So, yeah, it's very political because it's the AGs. That report that you read, that memo, that's what gets them promoted. That's what gets them into political office. Everyone's trying to make a name for themselves through prosecutions, through enforcement actions. I subscribe to, and I think every doctor should subscribe to, the OIG alerts, where the Office of Inspector General will tell you, these are the enforcement actions. It's nationwide. So it'll be like a doctor in Tennessee, a doctor in New Jersey, a doctor in Hawaii, a doctor everywhere. But you could see the patterns. You could see, you could read the tea leaves. What are they focusing in on? It's really unfortunate. It's very political, and people get ahead by taking licenses away and disciplining doctors.
Oh, boy. We're going to come back to that. So one of my questions now is, how does the board decide who to investigate? Is it mostly based on complaints? And if that's the case, who can bring a complaint to the board?
For the most part, in most states, you can't do it anonymously, although I've heard that in some states you are able to do it anonymously, which is horrible. The complaints, I would say, overwhelming majority come directly from patients. So it's a patient that will prepare a complaint, and then the board will just be like a vessel for it. It's like, hey, we received this complaint from a patient. We have one side of the story. We'd like to hear your side. Let us know what your response is.
is every complaint considered? The tone, it could be a complete crackpot sounding thing. My doctor used radio waves on me to take away my superpower.
So I will answer that with this. I've had two cases that I thought of when you asked that question. One was a case where I was retained to respond over a $40 copay. And then another one was a case where a patient was claiming that my client was racist because he would not allow him to keep a skin tag that was removed from his body. The doctor wanted to biopsy it. The patient wanted to take it and bury it as part of a religious tradition. So those two cases were real cases, and I actually had to defend them, and they were dismissed, obviously. They're full-time employees, the board members. They have their own stuff to do. They can't be reading through all of these complaints. Someone at the board takes a cursory reading only to make sure that there's not something that requires urgent or emergent action. If there's an accusation of like a pill mill or something that like just sounds lascivious, it's like, okay, we need to get this doctor before a committee ASAP, possibly even take their license. But the opposite is not true. They're like, oh, someone's complaining about a skin tag removal or a $20 copay. That's a complaint. Have the doctor answer it. The frivolous ones always get through.
So that's good to know. It's nice that you said that they were, you know, dismissed, obviously, because I think everyone lives in fear of like, what if they do decide against me because they seem to have unfettered, unchecked power? So if someone gets notice of a complaint from the board, first of all, that will probably come as a certified letter, or do you get served for malpractice cases, or what happens there?
One of the things that's happened recently is you have, unfortunately, more doctors receiving things via email. And because they're receiving it via email, they're missing it. It goes into their junk mail, or, you know, it comes from like a weird looking address. It doesn't come from like the Board of Medical Examiners. It's really weird.
That should not be allowed. There should definitely be a certified letter involved in this. Okay.
Exactly. It used to be certified, but now we're seeing it more via email. So you can get it via email. You can get it via regular mail. You can get it in many different ways, but that's about it. It's not a subpoena that you're getting from somebody. You're not being served.
Okay. All right. Good to know. Now, when you get that, what is the first thing that you should do? I think the inclination is if they say, okay, you're going to have to respond to this complaint, and someone is saying that I need to be disciplined because I sent the thing I removed from their skin to biopsy, my instinct is going to be in a panic, pick up the phone and be like, I just need to talk to somebody and explain what happened here so that you can just throw this thing out.
So the fastest way to get in trouble is not answering and not responding to a complaint. You have to answer it timely, and answer it thoroughly. The way that most physicians say get in trouble, if they decide not to retain counsel and do it on their own, is by having this misconception that, let me just explain it. We're colleagues. Let me just talk to them colleague to colleague, doctor to doctor. It's not a doctor to doctor conversation. They're investigating you. They're investigating this issue. There is an attorney there with the board, a deputy attorney general, who's reading your response, who's dissecting it, who's going to be putting it through a different lens. The other misconception is, well, if I get a lawyer, then they're going to think I'm guilty, you know? And we hear that all the time. It doesn't matter what matter. And I have yet in my career to see one instance where any investigator, anyone ever said, oh, you have an attorney? That's probably because you think you did something wrong. No, they understand the function of the attorney is to communicate and to advocate, but it's not to hide or conceal or get somebody, you know, off of something that they did wrong. That's not what lawyers do.
And I feel like that's part of this misconception that the doctors have about like who's on the board and what their function is, because I don't think any of us would want to go into a malpractice lawsuit without an attorney, just defending ourselves. Most of us know not to do that. We know that we need someone who knows the lay of the land and speaks the language and can serve as our guide, our Sherpa, and tell us how to be and how to show up. Somehow we don't think that that's the case for medical board investigations. And it may come down to this like, oh, you know, they're like our specialty board or whatever, or a professional society. And that's not the case. So that's one thing I'm really glad that we're clearing up. So obviously, you would probably say so. I think for most of the people that I've talked to about this issue would say that you should obtain an attorney to help you through this process. Now, one question that people always have is, who's paying for that attorney? Does your malpractice insurance help with this? Like, what happens there?
Right. So it does depend on what malpractice company you have. Some of them offer coverage if there's ever a subpoena that you get from the board, or if there's a letter that you get regarding a patient complaint. Others are a little more restrictive and say, we'll only defend you if there's allegations that could result in a med mal action against you, or that are potentially related to medical malpractice. So in a situation of a harmful or offensive touching, being inappropriate with a patient, that's not malpractice per se. That could be an assault case. That could be, you know, a number of different cases. That's not necessarily a med mal case per se. Then on top of that, you know, you have other cases that have to do like with billing and stuff like that, that are not. So you have to really make sure that when you have a broker who's getting your policy, you try to get the most inclusive policy that will cover the most areas.
Later, I want to talk about policies. Doctors or most professionals, they usually have no idea what's in their policy. They just have this assumption like, oh, I'll be taken care of because I'm insured. I didn't know what I was supposed to do when I was named. I didn't even know who my carrier was. I had no idea. Like, just not even like the first idea of who to call or what to do. So I think a reasonable first call is, if you don't know what's in your policy, would be your malpractice insurance carrier to talk to them about like, what are my resources, and find out how much of that is out of pocket. And they probably do know people who are good, reputable attorneys that are experienced in this realm. What kind of attorney are you?
MedMal attorneys are different from healthcare attorneys that do board work. You know, MedMal attorneys are in a much more contentious field. They're fighting a lot. The tone that you have to take when you go in before the board is much different. When you go before the Board of Medical Examiners here in New Jersey, or OPMC in New York, wherever you go, you have to show some deference. And you have to understand that you can't go in there objecting to things like you would at a deposition, at a trial, at a hearing, because it's almost a kangaroo court. They can do whatever they want. They can ask any questions that they want. They have wide berth over where they can go with it. You don't have the same protections that you would. So you need to have an attorney who understands that process and will prepare you for the off-the-wall questions you might get from board members. I've had questions from board members where they ask, well, what were you thinking when they told you that? Or what were they thinking when they asked you that? It's like, well, how would I know what somebody else was thinking? So the questions can be very like off the wall. So you have to be able to prepare your client.
There's no judge. They're not governed like in a malpractice. If you were at trial, or there are sort of rules governing like how they ask questions and what it is that you would be expected to be able to testify to. Like, you could not testify to what the other person is thinking, even if they asked you that, right? Someone's going to object. But emphasizing like, this is not a legal convening. This is, they're outside the purview of the regular law, but you know how to operate in that arena.
So the issue that you have is that on the one hand, you have a medical board that can take away your license, your ability to practice, that can restrict your license, that can basically destroy your practice, but you don't have the same right to object to a question than you would in a civil lawsuit where someone may be asking for $10,000. It's ridiculous when you think of it that way.
Another way that I think it differs from the legal system is that there's no like statute of limitations. If they get a complaint from someone that said like 15 years ago, this thing happened and I've been stewing over it and really angry and that person's still practicing and I want to lodge a complaint, they still have to investigate it.
Absolutely. I had a complaint once filed against a provider after I think 20 years from when they saw somebody. And at that point, 20 years ago, there was an EMR.
You know? Yeah.
So it's not like it's like, okay, well, let me just pull up the EMR visit from 20 years ago. No, it's like most states have a reasonable amount of time, like 7 years to keep records. So it was more than a decade since the records were trashed. And there was nothing that the provider could do other than come up with a response. We worked on something together. We crafted a good response. It got dismissed. But it's something that can unnerve you if your medical records, which are your shield to protect you in a case like this, don't exist anymore.
I feel badly at this moment because I feel like I'm just throwing out this information that is terrifying people. But I do think it's super important that people understand how these things work, because typically physicians who are going through this board investigation experience, when it's really not warranted and find themselves really, really stuck, they're not talking about it. There's no way for other doctors to know that this is happening. There is no way to check this sort of unfettered power of the board. But it is, I think, important to know, because you cannot influence anything until you understand what the reality is currently. And perhaps people do want to influence this, but you have to be very tactical about how you do it, first of all. But you just got to understand where you stand first. All right. So we've covered the makeup of the board, what the board is ostensibly, how they operate, that they're really not, you know, legal per se. They have to investigate any complaint. Anyone can bring a complaint about something that happened at any time, and all of those things are going to be investigated. The corollary to that is that everyone should understand that just because a doctor is being investigated means nothing about who they are as a doctor.
Correct. And I will say that I speak a lot on this issue and other issues, and it's never with the intent to scare anyone. It's twofold. One, to understand the reality of it. Listen, as doctors, you have to give bad news, unfortunately, to a lot of people a lot of time. And also warn them, like, hey, if you keep eating like this and smoking and drinking, this is going to happen. If you don't get vaccinated, if you this happen, you know. So there is a little bit of scare tactics in a way, but it's not because you're trying to elicit a response, because you need to make an informed decision. So if you get a letter from the board tomorrow, do you want to go on your own, understanding the rules are really there to be enforced against you? You have attorneys on their side working with them. You have, if it's a hearing, a kangaroo process where they can ask you any questions at any time. Do you want to do all of that by yourself or work with somebody who can help you? If you prep for it like you would for a deposition, like you went through in your prior podcast, you can get through it. You know, it's going in there unprepared, going in there with a laissez-faire attitude, thinking, I'm just going to talk to him, doctor, doctor, we'll get this squared away. I have represented too many doctors after they've received a consent order disciplining them, because they went in unrepresented to a hearing, that I beat the drum. If you ever are called in for a hearing, I don't care if you retain me. Retain somebody, healthcare counsel, someone who understands, you know, healthcare, someone who understands the intricacies of what it is that you do. It's not your cousin who's a real estate broker. It has to be someone who understands healthcare. Next to nuclear energy, healthcare is the most regulated industry in the United States. Why would you have somebody who doesn't understand the regulations that could, you know, lead to discipline? Retain somebody and understand that you can prep for this so that it's not a stressful situation when you go through it. I could tell you that investigations, for the most part, they all start confidential. If they get resolved, they remain confidential. They get put in the board's confidential vault. You cannot get that information through a subpoena. You cannot get that through a FOIA request. It is the strictest of confidentiality when a board dismisses that.
Now, what if you go through a hearing and they discipline you? What are the possible outcomes there?
That is the worst case scenario, obviously. Once you get disciplined, it goes in the National Practitioner Data Bank. And that is an information repository that gets then disseminated to everybody who is an entity that receives National Practitioner Data Bank reports, meaning hospitals, meaning payers, private and public, meaning other medical boards. It really starts a domino effect. And now what started off as one investigation where you got disciplined becomes multiple other investigations. Now Horizon is coming after, or United Healthcare, saying, well, why were you disciplined? If you lost your prescribing privileges, now you may lose your board certification, because I think certain boards, like ABIM, I believe, is one of them, requires you to have an unrestricted license, and losing your ability to prescribe is considered a license restriction. If you have a restricted license and you can't prescribe, now you're going to get kicked out of every hospital, because hospitals require you to have some prescribing privileges. You're going to lose credentials. You're going to possibly get kicked out of private payers. CMS, I haven't seen them come after, but if Medicaid comes after you, then Medicare has to come after you. So it just starts this domino effect. So best thing you can do for yourself is make sure that from the very beginning, you don't get disciplined, you know? It's like avoiding being arrested, because once you get arrested, you go into the system.
Now, what if you wanted to appeal? Like, what if you really felt like, I don't deserve this? What's my recourse? What do you do?
Okay, so there are two types of discipline. If you're talking about agreeing to a consent order.
Oh, can you define consent order?
What happens is, when the board investigates you, if they find that you have done something that requires discipline, be it a slap on the wrist or taking your license away, the way that they do it is by sending you a order, and that order outlines the elements for taking disciplinary action against you, and as a result, what they're doing. So they'll say, because you failed to check the prescription monitoring program, and this person was clearly looking for drugs, and you missed drug-seeking behavior, as a result, we're going to take away your DEA or your state prescribing. You have to agree to that. You have to sign off on it. That's why it's a consent order, because the board signs it and you sign it. It's an agreement to be disciplined in that amount. Sometimes it includes a fine, some costs, all these things. And that one you can't appeal because you consented. You would have to vacate a consent order. That requires a lot of work. I've been able to do that in the past, but it's a Herculean effort. You basically have to show that you didn't know what you were signing into, or the attorney that they hired before didn't know what they were doing.
Well, what if you don't consent in the first place?
So that brings me to my second point. If you don't consent, then what the board does is, we've been talking a lot about complaints. Here's where there's a little bit of, it's a term of art here, okay? So there's a patient complaint that the board investigates. If they're going to discipline or want to discipline you, then the board files a complaint. That's a board complaint. So when the board thinks that you've done something wrong, they file a complaint. It looks just like a complaint from a civil lawsuit. It's going to have a caption. It's going to look exactly like that. The only issue is, once they file that complaint goes to the National Practitioner Data Bank. So now everyone knows, it's public. When you have a public complaint, then you get to file an answer. It kind of plays out like a mini civil trial. You get some discovery from them, which normally you wouldn't get discovery for a board action. You get to have a hearing. You go before an administrative law judge. And at the end of that, the administrative law judge, here's where I really hate the system, will come up with not a decision, but with an opinion saying, Dr. Smith did everything right, you know, so we're not going to discipline Dr. Smith. Okay. It goes back to the full board of medical examiners. And then they have the option to reject it, accept it, or accept it in part, reject it in part. So you've gone through maybe like a year or two of litigation, and then now it goes back to the board, and the board can say, ah, you know what? We don't agree with ALJ. We're still going to suspend your license or do whatever we want. At that point, though, that's very rare, because then you do have a pretty good argument, in my opinion, that the board is acting arbitrary and capricious, not being unbiased in their opinion. Then that brings personal exposure to board members. So you don't have that kind of immunity where you can do whatever you want. That's where there's a check and balance there. So we haven't seen that. Most of the time, they do just accept whatever the ALJ says. But there is always that risk.
I think this is where we let it rest today. That's a lot of information. Again, coming back to this, most people don't have to get embroiled in this, but many good doctors do. Again, what I really want people to take away from this is that if a doctor you know of is being investigated, you can't make that assumption. Just like if a case is settled in malpractice, you can't make the assumption that the doctor did something wrong, because you need to know how the system operates first. We're going to talk about this stuff more. I just felt like we just needed some basic education on the topic. We will come back to it. We'll be talking about specific cases. I know there are people out there who have been writing me that want to talk about specific cases. We'll do that. We've got a lot of things to talk about, a lot of things to learn. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Guillermo, for coming to talk to us about this. I appreciate your time, as do our listeners.
Of course. Listen, it's nothing to be ashamed of to have a complaint filed against you. They can be filed by patients. They can be filed by competitors. We've seen that. They can be filed by other doctors who don't understand what happened. Just because you receive a letter from the board saying, we would like a response. And just very briefly, there's a couple of ways they can come at you. They can ask you for a written response. They can ask you to come in for a hearing. If you come in for a hearing, that's when there's smoke, there's fire type of situation. But if they ask you for a letter, I can tell you that from personal experience, I think in the hundreds that I've done, probably 98% of them were closed with one well-crafted letter. So it's not the end of the world if they ask you for something in writing. That's just a situation where get your information together, gather your facts, get a nice narrative. And then where counsel helps is we help tell the story better. And we kind of can take a step back and take the emotion out of it. I tell my clients, give me a response, throw in all the vitriol you want into it. I'm going to edit it. Okay. I'm going to make sure that it sounds very nice. And at the same time, as your attorney, I can say things you can't, as you have to be above the fray. I am your advocate. I can say things in a nice manner that you can't. So when you work together as a team, you can get great results. So that's not the end of the world if you get a letter from the board. I don't want people walking away from this traumatized. The amount of board complaints, where the board files a complaint, very, very few, very rare.
It's an important distinction to make.
It's an important distinction to know, yeah.
I think that just knowing that there are people who are experts at this is pretty common to have board, to have patient complaints administered. And there's, you know, sometimes people feel like if a lawyer won't take their case, this is the only way they can, you know, exert any kind of influence or be heard. And so there are lots of motivations. And we come back to this all the time, this notion of being able to control your emotions in order to perform well in a given arena. This is another one of those circumstances. I do believe that having an attorney help you from the beginning is probably the way you're going to want to go. Thank you so much for your expertise and your time, and we will revisit. I appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having me. I hope this helps. Not my intention to scare.
I think it's important that people just understand the reality of a situation. So thank you for that. And then we'll talk more about, again, like what you did was give us a glimpse into, like, if you show up in a certain way, like, it's going to go your favor. It's just one of these unfortunate inevitabilities sometime in medicine that, you know, it might come up at some point. And the more we understand that it's a common thing to have to deal with a complaint, not common for it to go all the way, and how to protect yourself from that in the first place, I think that's all great advice.
It's unfortunate because since COVID, we've seen a lot less civility and a lot more, I just say, craziness across the board. People are quicker to complain and to ramp up to rage much faster.
Well, we're going to revisit that. Again, thank you for your time. This is so instructive.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, my friends, that was a lot of information. I hope you learned as much as I did. As I said, we will come back to this topic. I believe that knowledge about these processes will keep all of us in a better place. And the more we talk about these things openly, the more that we can affect change. You know, maybe ask someone on your board of licensure and discipline to come speak to your medical staff or to your residency program. You can prime the listeners by having them hear this interview first so that they know the basics, or they can read Guillermo's article in Medical Economics. I will link to it in the show notes. Find out how to get involved with the board yourself, because we need good and motivated people in this space, you know? Find out about legislative changes that could affect the board. Keep track of what the board is doing. I think it would serve us all well. I will see everybody next month when we are going to talk about a totally different topic. We're going to talk about using mindfulness in medical malpractice litigation.